Hi, my name is Lennon Dokubo. I'm a Loyola graduate in 2015. I'm 22 years old. Today is November 5th, 2015, in Chicago, Illinois. And I know Sister Jean, who I'll be interviewing, as she was my team chaplain as a member of the Loyola men's basketball team.
And good morning. I'm Sister Jean. My full name is Sister Jean Dolores Schmidt, BVM. I'm a Sister of Charity and the Blessed Virgin Mary. Our mother house is in Dubuque, Iowa. However, I work for Loyola University, out of campus ministry, and I'm the chaplain to the men's basketball team. Loyola is Chicago's Catholic Jesuit university, and we have the privilege of educating over 16,000 students to become extraordinary people by doing ordinary things, by learning about social justice, practicing it, helping others, taking care of ourselves, and being conscious of environmental changes and conscious of the people who live around us and serving the poor.
So we'd like to start off today by interviewing Sister Jean over here. And why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about your early childhood days?
Well, I was born in San Francisco, and it's a city, everybody's favorite city as far as I'm concerned. However, I have adapted my ways of life in Chicago. But I was born in San Francisco in 1937, which is a long time ago. And I had a very happy childhood. My early years, my mother and dad explained to us how much God loved us and that we need to love him. We need to love all the people around us, and that we also need to share whatever we have with other people. So as time grew on, we followed those principles, and we'll talk more about love if we have time to do that. But when I was a child, we had an ark, and an ark lasts like Noah's ark, and it was in Marin County. So we used to take the ferry boat over to Marin County from San Francisco and spend the weekends there. And the ark was located on a tributary of the San Francisco Bay. And we always had a lot of fun over there, swam, fished, took fishing trips down out into the big bay.
Did you have a good view of the Golden Gate Bridge when you were out there? Was it near it?
In those early days, there was no Golden Gate Bridge. First of all, it was just the ferry boats. And my grandmother especially used to get very worried because on the last boat they just had a little block. And she was always afraid the car would go into the bay, you know. So she was very nervous. But the Golden Gate Bridge was not finished until 1937. And my mom and I walked across that bridge the very first day. And it cost us 5 cents each. Today, I think the fare is probably up for a car is probably up to about $10 round trip now. And they always said they were never going to charge. But the Golden Gate Bridge is really an historic place. And the San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge, too, came later. So it was just fun to be from a city like that.
Definitely, definitely. And going back to your childhood days, most of us have pets when we're young. And rumor has it that you had a pet monkey. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. We had a little dog just for overnight. Our coal man, because we heated the house by wooden coal, the coal man brought us one of the litter. And the dog cried all night long. So my dad said, no dog. But then we had a friend who was an engineer on a cargo boat that went to South America. And when he left, he said, what would you like me to bring from South America? And my two brothers and I said, a monkey. That was all we could think of. And so they were bringing a monkey to the San Francisco Zoo, and they didn't know she was pregnant. And the international law was that if the mother gave birth on the ship, they couldn't bring the offspring into the zoo. So the captain said, well, who would like the monkey? And this fella said, I know three kids who would die for it. So he brought him to our house, and we called him Jerry. And Jerry was just so much fun to have. And my dad fixed him with a little cage in the basement. And then my mom used to bring him coffee and toast down in the morning, and he would just pick up the mug and dunk his toast into the coffee. And because he found it so cold in San Francisco, my mom knitted him a little sweater. And then he had a big cage outside for when it was nice. And then we had him for about 5 years, and then one day somebody cut a big hole in the cage and stole him, and we never did get him back. And then we also had an alligator.
Oh my gosh.
The alligator was about a foot long, and my aunt from Florida happened to bring him. My brother was born the next day, so she said that was my brother's birth present. And we kept him for about 5 years, too. Of course, he never grew much, but, oh, he loved hamburger. We would drop it on his head when he was walking around. And then my dad and mother thought it was about time that we give the alligator to the conservatory in San Francisco. So that's what happened there to our alligator. So we know that he lived a good life and was well taken care of there.
Were you ever scared of these pets? Like having a monkey climb all over the place or an alligator is not the norm.
We had fun, but once he was permitted to come upstairs, he jumped on the hot stove. And he burned both his paws very badly. And so my dad put on what was used for medicinal purposes for burns in those days was Kip. I don't think any pharmaceutical company makes it today. But he put Kip on his hands, and Jerry liked it so much he kept licking it. And so the saliva is what healed his hands faster than the Kip did. So it was just kind of fun. And then after grade school, I went to high school. To St. Paul's High School, and then I entered the convent.
Nice.
Could you talk a little bit about what motivated you to enter the convent?
I was in third grade, and we had a wonderful sister there who told us that we should be praying to God to help us decide what we wanted to do. Now, I remember in third grade, we were just about 8 years old. So I tried to get God to do what I wanted. And so I said, please, God, tell me what to do and say I'm to be a BVM sister. And that's what I am. And I've been that since 1937. And it was just my calling to life. And, of course, in those days, we went to Dubuque, as I mentioned, and I should tell you this, that when I entered the convent, people weren't traveling in planes very often at all, and the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge was not completed, so we had to take the ferry boat to Oakland, and then we took a train to Dubuque, Iowa, with a transfer in a place, someplace in Nebraska, Green Island, I think it was, and we traveled 3 nights and 2 days. To get to,
wow.
to there. And so it was like a vacation.
So then how did you end up in Chicago then, where you've been for the past?
Well, when we were in what we call the novitiate, which is a training place for young women who wish to become religious sisters, we went to school there because the sisters from Clark College in Dubuque, Iowa, came over to teach us. So we were taking college courses while we were preparing to learn about poverty, chastity, and obedience, which are the three vows we take. And since we were an active community in education, we were trained to be teachers. So after I made my profession of vows, like people make profession of their marriage vows, we made profession of the vows we were taking, and I was sent to Chicago, and that was in 1941. And I taught at St. Vincent's School, and that was on the Chicago's north side. But that school is no longer in existence. I just stayed there for a year and a half. And then this trip is a little long when I talk about it now. But then I was changed to different schools out there. And one was St. Bernard's School. And that was in Eagle Rock. And Eagle Rock is between Glendale and Los Angeles. And so at St. Bernard's School, the only thing that was there when we got there was the foundation. So we taught in various parts of the parish in order to take care of the children that we had. And it was a very poor parish. And we completed our new school the day before Pearl Harbor. So then we fell into a whole new type of life where boys and girls became latchkey children because their mothers had to go to work, their fathers had to go to war. And that's a whole other story. But that story made us all very close to each other and to God. And it was a very scary time.
Yeah, I'm sure going through any, if you're alive during World War II, that's a pretty, we only hear about it in history books now that I'm, you know, gone through grade school and all that, but having lived during that time, I can't even imagine what that experience had to be like, and having to look over all the little kids who had their parents working and even going to war. That must be huge responsibility at such a young age as well.
Yeah, it was very frightening. And the children had to wear what we call dog tags because they would not be destroyed by a bomb. And that if their bodies were found someplace, they would have their address and their telephone number on so we could notify. We had to keep blankets and food in school in case we had to keep them overnight. But we never had to do that. They could always go home, but they always had to go home the same way, come to school the same way every day. It was a very traumatic experience for them.
Definitely.
And for all of us.
So we know that you're a huge basketball fan, and you've been for many years now. And so how did you start getting involved with basketball? Did you play, or did you coach? How'd you get started?
Well, eventually I was changed to another school, which was called St. Charles in North Hollywood. And we built a new school there, too. And so I asked the pastor, I said to him, you know, it'd be so nice if we could participate in sports because we have the Catholic Youth Organization and we would just love to do that, you know. And he said, well, will you take care of it? And I said, oh, sure. You know, very calmly, I was probably about 25 years old taking on this whole group of children. And I was teaching eighth grade. And we were the largest school west of the Mississippi River. We had 1,000 children in our grade school. And we kept growing all the time. And so then I became the coach of especially the girls' basketball, volleyball, softball, ping pong, and yo-yo. And one year we had the archdiocesan yo-yo champ. And that was quite a sport out there. In California, we were never without a sport. All season long, we were just doing it all the time. So I coached them. I coached the girls. And when I was in high school is when I learned how to play basketball. But in those days, the court was in three sections. So there were two guards and two forwards at each end. And in the middle were two sides and two centers. And since I was a little girl, I was a side. And so you could never step out of your boundary lines, and nobody could shoot for a basket except the forwards. But by the time I got 1941, the girls were beginning to play half court, which made the game a lot more active. And that's when we coached them. And we did go to the playoffs and the tournaments and all that. And when the coach for the boys couldn't come, then I would coach the boys. And then at noontime, we always had a boys and girls game, and it kept everybody in the playground very interested, and there were no fights or pushing around. Everybody wanted to see who was playing. But I always told the boys, I said, you have to hold back a little bit, and you have to play girls' rules, because otherwise we're not going to make this work. We have to toughen our girls. So that's how I got interested.
Could you describe your coaching style?
My coaching style? Well, we, in those days, there was no such thing as training and running and exercise or anything like that. So, but most of the children had to walk to school, and that was a pretty good walk for them, no matter where they lived in the area. And so we would, we talked about the rules. We had to learn the rules, first of all, because the rules were very few in those days, but the refs were as tough as they are today. And so we had to learn the rules. And then we would just go out, and I never tried to shoot a basket because I was in a habit at that time and sort of confined in my actions. So I would have somebody practice and be the demonstrator on how to do it, what they are supposed to do. And as I watched you guys playing, and as I watched yesterday, I watched the basketball do their practice, I thought to myself, well, This is probably what I did when I was doing this with eighth graders, but not in such an intense atmosphere at all. But we always had that competitive spirit. And one of the things was that because we had rules in our community too, we did not go out at night, so I could never go to a night game. But I'd always give somebody who was going just a handful of nickels, because it cost a nickel to call on a payphone. And so I'd give him a handful of nickels and say, call me if anything bad's happened. So then they'd call and they'd say, Sister Jean, get the sisters to go to the chapel and pray. We're 2 points behind.
Oh, my gosh.
So we used to just have fun doing that. And then in order to have their parents take them to games, we have a crowd there, I would give them homework tickets. And a homework ticket meant that they could not do their homework in one subject on one night. And they could hand that in if they were too busy going to a game. And they took that. They treasured those tickets. They never lost them. They always had them in case of need.
Maybe Loyola should do that now. Maybe get some extra fans to the game, some more students.
I don't know whether the faculty would appreciate my doing that now. But it was fun doing it anyhow. So that was the beginning of my my whole thing. But I have to say, as I mentioned, in my early childhood, too, we had more boys on the street than we had girls. And so the girls also played football and when we were younger. When we were older, the boys didn't want us doing anything like that. But so, I'd like to go back to one more story. And when I was younger in grade school, and I'm sure you remember that story.
Oh yes. Hold on. Let me touch on this one. So I also heard another story, another very eventful one of a Valentine's Day story, back in second grade, I think it was. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, you have a good memory, London. Yeah, the Valentine's story is a favorite among the students when I tell it too, and I always tell it around Valentine's Day, of course. When we were in second grade, we had a Valentine box in the front of the room and put our Valentines in there that we wanted distributed among the boys and girls in our room. And in the afternoon, our teacher would pulled out the Valentines and called out the names. And she came to one and it said, to Charles D. from me. And she called me and she said, we don't have a Charles D. in this room. And I said, oh, I know. He's in sixth grade. So she said, well, I think it'd be nice if you took the Valentine up to him. So I went up the stairs and knocked at the door and stood my full seven-year-old height and said to the sister, I had a Valentine for Charles DeLay. And so she called him up to the front of the room and said, Charles, I think you should accept this Valentine. He probably was so embarrassed in front of sixth grade boys looking at this second grade girl to take a Valentine. But that's all right. I liked him. I don't know exactly why, but I did. And so did I ever see him again? Well, probably when we were playing in the yard where the boys and girls were divided by a chain fence. Then he graduated from eighth grade and went on to St. Ignatius High School. Now, his brother was in my class, but I had nothing to do with Ed. Charles was my idol. And then he later became a Jesuit after high school. He was the president of the University of San Francisco. And then he had a very important position in Rome in the Jesuit society there.
Wow.
And I kept reading about him in the papers and news and hearing about him, and he just died about maybe 5 years ago now.
Wow.
I don't think he ever knew that I about our relationship, but that's the way it went. So it was just a fun second grade thing. And you know what? That part of the heartstrings happens today too, because just not too long ago, one of our preschool teachers told me that they had been talking about, you know, loving God and everything in their class. And so this little boy came in one morning and he walked up to this little girl and he said, I suppose you're going to ask if I'm going to marry you. And he said, the answer is no, but I'll give you a kiss this morning anyhow. So whether that's love or whatever it is, you know, it We can't live without it.
Definitely.
It's never gone. If people lose love from their heart, they've lost everything. So those are the things that have kind of stayed with me all the time, because I can see the same things happening in with the adult students.
For sure.
That go on. Mm-hmm.
So then going back to basketball, how did you start getting involved with the Loyola basketball team? When did that start? And
well, actually, I was at Mundelein for 30 years teaching the women in that college to become teachers in the Chicago public and private schools, Catholic schools. And we just couldn't make it anymore, so we affiliated with Loyola in 1991. And then I became an academic advisor there at Loyola. And then in 1994, Loyola offered a great retirement package, which my community suggested that I take because it was good, and I could also work in addition to being retired. And so the then president said, "Oh, I know what you can do. You can help the young women and men basketball players who have a difficult time in adjusting to college classes and to giving so much time for sports, especially in basketball." So he said, "You can work with them and just help booster their spirits." So I called myself the booster shooter. So those young men and women came to see me once a week. We talked about time management and preparation for classes. I was not their tutor. I was just what I said, their booster shooter. And then everybody was doing fine, so they didn't need me in that capacity anymore. So I was invited to be the chaplain. And he said to me, I said, "Well, that'd be fine. I've never been a chaplain to a men's basketball team, but I would like to do that." So that's how I got with the basketball team, with the men's, because they designated it would be men's. And so for years I was the only woman chaplain for a men's team. And I love doing it. I love talking to all of you guys. I have to say you too, London, even though you're, graduated. But it's just been fun. I've learned from the young men, and hopefully they've learned from me too. They know I'm there for them all the time. I go to the home games and the games that are local. No, I don't travel with the teams, as you know, because you don't have to worry about me. You have enough worrying about getting that ball into the basket, and that's what's important. So, as you could testify to this, that I do go to the games, pray with a team ahead of time. Sometimes the prayer isn't that holy. It's more of a scouting prayer. But sometimes we're on target. We're both on the same page, and that's important. I pray with the fans. Of course, I always put in a little extra thing for that God will do something for us. And it's in one of the prayers I brought. I thought I'd say something about one of the prayers I said a couple of years ago. Is that okay?
Yeah, definitely.
I always start out with good and gracious God. You know, it's our pleasure today to welcome whatever team comes to play with us, and that we ask God to protect them from injuries. We don't want to lose anybody early in the season or any time in the season to injuries. We want each team to do its best. But in this particular prayer, I said, "Ramblers, jump right in there, get the tip-off, and play as though this is one of the final four games. And ask God to please make us have a big W at the end." So that, and the fans, many fans from the other schools come and say to me, "Oh, thank you for including us in your prayers." And I said, "Oh, that's fine." And last year, when we played Wichita State for the first time, one of the assistant coaches is a Loyola Rambler basketball player from a couple of years ago. And I said, "Oh, Dominic, I hope you lose tonight." And he said, "Oh, no, not tonight, Sister Jean." And I said, "It'd be wonderful if you lost one game before you put your foot on the NCAA floor." They went a long way in the playoffs in the March Madness. But they didn't win, of course. But that's okay. They learned. And that's what we do in basketball. We learn what we're supposed to do in life at the same time as playing sports.
Definitely. I remember when I first my first game as a freshman, when I knew that you were a chaplain, but I didn't really know what the prayers were going to be like. And I definitely didn't know you had a whole scouting report planned. I was convinced you met with the coaches beforehand because you gave us each player's number and what they could do, and I was really, really surprised. And even after that, even after the games, every game you sent us an email, personalized email saying how we did. Nothing bad, of course. Not usually. Maybe once in a while.
You didn't get any bad ones.
Usually encouraging. No, always positive. But it just goes to show how dedicated to the team you are and how much it really means to all of us. And it's real special for all of us. And I'm going to attest to all of the team members on that one.
Thank you, Linda.
Definitely. So you've been around in about, 20 different teams. You've probably seen over hundreds of games. This is before our time, but the game had changed in 1963 with the 1963 National Championship team. I know that we've heard all about it. We had the 50th anniversary 2 years ago, and that's affected us as a team because we've met all those players most of the players that are still around. And there's been a big emphasis on how it changed college basketball and the racial color barrier and all that. So can you talk a little bit about that and what it meant to you?
Oh, I'd love to. Even though I was not with Loyola at the time, I used to go over and watch the games because I was always interested in the basketball. So I knew Loyola was getting toward the big deal, to do the real dance. And the dance then is different from the dance today. But first of all, that game was the 63 game. Was televised. It was delayed television. And I remember another sister and I were watching it. I think it began like at 10 o'clock Chicago time. And we had a little black and white, there was no such thing as color TV in those days, a black and white TV, about 11-inch screen, where we watched every moment of the game. And when the final shot was made and we won, it was just like an explosion happened in the city because all the guys from Campion Hall, and Loyola had all boys at that time, came down Sheridan Road and came to Coffee Hall where all the Mundelein women lived. And they both went down the white line Sheridan Road and walked north toward Evanston saying, "We won, we won, we won." And so it was so exciting for us, and we really celebrated that a lot, plus the 50th anniversary. And previous to that, to the semifinal game, of course, was what we call a game of change because that was against Mississippi. And the governor of the state had said that the school could not No schools could play a racially combined basketball team. And Loyola was that. We were about 50-50. And it was such a dramatic change in history when the white student from Mississippi and the black student from Loyola shook hands before the game began. And We owe a great deal of credit to Mississippi, too, because they went out of the state against the governor's desire and came and played us in the semifinals.
Absolutely.
And that was really, really great. So we've had a lot of happy memories with our basketball players and with our athletes. And I keep saying our athletes are the best time managers in the university, because you spend so many hours pushing the school forward, pushing your sport forward, and competing in the right sense of the word. And we're well represented all over the country.
Yeah.
Definitely. And all over the world, really, because we have people playing on professional teams in the Czech Republic, in France, Germany, South America. That's just to name a few. So it's nice that we can share our talents with other people.
Could the two of you share what a typical day is? Playing basketball at Loyola, and the work you do on a day-to-day basis.
Why don't you go ahead first, London?
A typical day during the season, typically all our classes are in the morning, so we'll have class from 8:15 until about noon, 12:30, and then we have to go get a lift in either before or after practice for an hour. So basically we get to the gym around 1 o'clock and we won't leave there until 6 or 7 p.m. It's long days. Most of the time you go in and it's daylight, you come back out and it's nighttime. It's a big 5 to 6 hour gap of your day that's gone. You have 3 hour practices plus an hour of lifting, and then you got to get treatment. And right after you get done with practice, you have study hall, you got to eat dinner. It's a constant. It's basically, it's 1 to 9 every day of some sort of basketball commitment. Also film you got to watch. So every day you got full days, and the one day a week you get a day off it's like Christmas, because you finally get to just relax and not do anything. But a typical day is all booked the entire day.
Yeah. Oh, I believe that. I think you have a hard time even sometimes finding a time to eat.
Yes.
Because you can't be eating just before you practice, and then you have to rush. It's a very complicated day for them. My day, I don't have a typical day. it sort of changes because I give time on both campuses, Lakeshore campus and Water Tower campus. And I come out of the Department of Campus Ministry, which comes from the student development, but I'm equally involved with that, athletics. And I also do things for other departments, too. I'm a good co-worker. But my day starts early in the morning because I like to take care of my quiet time and meditating and prayer. I go to Mass during the course of the day, depending on where I am, what time it is. Then I go to my office. I have an office downtown, and I share an office at Lakeshore. And my purpose is just to be walking around and talking to students and having appointments with them and just seeing how they're doing. And sometimes it's just that morning question, or how are you doing today, makes them think, well, it is a beautiful day. Yeah, I should be good. Everybody should be really enjoying this day. Like now we say, oh, can you believe it's really November? It's warmer than it was in spring. Maybe we're all turned around as everybody else is. I spend my day until 5 o'clock either going to meetings or and one of the big meetings now that we're having is for what we call Arch Madness. And it's called Arch Madness because that's our valley. Our conference is the Missouri Valley. And we go to St. Louis, where the Arch is, for the playoffs. All our teams play in St. Louis. And it is such a fun event. And this is just our third year in the Valley, and we have Father Garanzini to thank, who is our former president and now our chancellor, to help us get into this particular conference because it has raised our level. And I keep saying to our teams, we're raising the level of the Valley as well. We're doing especially well this year. So Arch Madness is a great event where we spend... It depends on how many games we win. And we were very fortunate the first year there with Milton making a buzzer drop into the basket. And perhaps sometimes we're making some enemies in other schools because we're taking away the glory from them. And then last year we went on to the semifinals. Yeah. And this year... last year we were predicted to be number 10, and we came in number 6 in our conference. This year we're predicted to be number 5, but CBS says that they wouldn't be surprised if we were number 3. So that gives us a boost to go up. And it's better to even be number 5, listed as number 5 and get up, than it is to be number 1 and come down. We don't want to do that. So, and then that's a little aside into what I do all day. But then...
could you walk me through, like, a game day?
Oh, I will get that. Yeah. Okay, all right. Then good, we'll suppose this is a basketball game. So then I rush home and get my dinner. And a home to me is a residence hall where I live with 400 students. This year it's transfers and sophomores, and they're really good people, and we love the hall we live in. Previously it was all freshmen, and it makes a difference how we all interact now. It's a little different from before. We're more mature and so forth. So we're doing very well. I rush home. Then, of course, I change into my basketball clothes. I'm so Loyola Don that no one would mistake me for any other institution. I wear my sweatshirt with Loyola Ramblers on it. I have shoes that the basketball team, men's basketball team, gave me. They're Nike IDs, Loyola's colors, maroon and gold, with my name on the back. One says sister, the other says Jean. I've had more pictures of my feet than my face. And so it's just fun to be there. And then I have a special place to sit. I have a reserved seat, not on the bench, because everybody's afraid I'll get hit by the ball, and that could really happen. Just to do an aside, I was hit by a volleyball twice in one night and had two black eyes. I was hit by a soccer ball last year and broke my arm by being hit with a soccer ball. So I'm way up, but in a special place where I can see everything, and it's a really good place to be. It's right at half court, and I can see everything. So then I get there about an hour ahead of time just to be talking to the band who's already there, and the dance, the spirit teams, and let them know I feel a part of them too. Then the team comes out for their final warm-up, and we say our prayer together, and we're in a huddle. And then I say, 7 minutes before the game, I say the prayer with the fans. I always introduce myself to the referees, and sometimes I say, I hope their sight is good tonight. I want them to call the same kind of mistakes on both sides. And then we play the game, and of course, we're a noisy crowd. Even if we don't have hundreds of thousands there, we make as much noise as they do. And many times we invite the boys and girls, or the young men and women from Misericordia, which is a place for special people, and they love coming and cheer. They always know they cheer for Loyola. And yeah. Then we invite other elementary schools and high schools there. When we have special occasions, sometimes I'm a judge for a dunking or anything. Anything like that. So it's my life, and then I go home and absolutely collapse. But it's fun. it's fun to be part of this generation that is so different from when I grew up, and to know that I can relate to them. Well, my vocabulary gets increased all the time with all these new things. But then now we're beginning to use some of the words we used when, you know, when I was growing up, and I think, oh, here the wheel goes round and round. And that's all okay.
London, could you share something that is memorable that Sister Jean has shared with you during, like, before a game, or something that you remember fondly?
I'm trying to think of a specific time. But you generally she's been to all of our home games, but when it's a rare occasion that she does come to one of our away games, sometimes, and it's usually a surprise for us, because, you know, we'll just come back from warm-ups, and then she's waiting in the locker room for us, and we have no idea. And especially when we're at Arch Madness, both years, we didn't really know she was coming, and she showed up, and I definitely feel like it gave us a boost of confidence, just the security, you know, that Sister Jean was there and she's looking over us, giving us a good prayer. Because on the road, we pray as a team. Regardless. But just to have one from Sister Jean is definitely more special for us. So I definitely say that the road games that we get her to travel with us and come out are definitely a little more special to us. Oh. And I definitely think it helps us. Definitely do.
Oh, thank you. Well, I like to do that too, because one time I met the team in California. And they didn't expect me at St. Mary's Moraga. And I got there, and they just couldn't believe it. But I didn't want to tell. I was coming because it was winter. I was going home to visit my family. And so I thought, well, if I don't get there, they'll be disappointed. So, but I got there and got to see everybody. So that was fun. And then sometimes it's a hard deal to get to the men's locker room, because I remember when we went to do playoffs at one place, and I said to the guard, oh, I would like to go to the men's locker room. And she looked at me and she said, if I let you do that, I'd lose my job. I said, oh, my goodness. How could you possibly think? So anyhow, I said, well, where are the Loyola Ramblers? And she said, they're right up here in the stand watching what's the game that's going on. So the team came down, and we prayed right there in the concourse. And people actually stood around and wondered what we were doing. But we did that. And a woman came to me, and she said, I'm going to root for your team because I never saw such a beautiful action before. And I thought, well, that was really neat. So, I don't go to the games because, as I said, you know, I want them to make those baskets and not worry about what I'm doing. But, and this year the team's been invited to the shootout in Anchorage.
Yep. Yeah, Alaska. It's going to be.
And that's going to be really great. And so, they'll be there over Thanksgiving. So I just think maybe I've talked too much, London, and not given you a chance. So if you have anything else to say, please do it.
Just on a side note, going back to, like you said, you have your customized Nike that you got from the team. And also, there's been a few games where they've handed out bobbleheads they made bobbleheads of you, and I'm sure everybody's gotten one. I definitely have a couple, but how do you feel about that? Is that something is it funny? You like it? Shows your celebrity status, I'd say.
When they first mentioned it to me, I thought they were joking, and then pretty soon they presented a picture to me of the bobblehead, and then they were there, and it's been fun. It's been a lot of fun to have them, and so far I'm the only one to have a bobblehead until the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the 1963 team, and then they each had one too.
Yeah. Yes, that was, they handed out at least five or six of those. Uh-huh. So also during, since I don't get to see you during games, since I was been on the bench, obviously, so like how do you, when we have all those, we've had a number of close games over the years, and where it's come down to the last possession, the last point. And how do you get real nervous during those situations? Are you can't watch, or how do you react?
Well, of course I get very, very nervous. And I tell you guys, you know, I carry my nitro with me just in case I might need it, but I've never had to really use it. So I'm glad about that. But of course I'm right there almost playing with you, you know, but you come through. And it's just been such a pleasure for me to work with all of you. And just to think about how great you are in what you do for other people by bringing joy into their lives. And I just think that, as I mentioned before, love is such an important part in our lives, with our friends, with our families, with God. And I would just like, because I know that you and I only have a certain amount of time together today, I would just like to close by saying what I call Father Pedro Arrupe's love prayer. He was a Father General in the Society of Jesus. And he says that nothing is so practical as finding God, and that is falling in love in a quite absolute and final way. What you fall in love with will seize your imagination, will affect everything. It will decide what gets you out of bed in the morning, what you do with your evenings, how you spend your weekends, what attracts you, what you read, who you know, what amazes you with joy and gratitude. So fall in love, stay in love, and it will decide everything. And to me, that's a life prayer. And when you reflect on it, you think, yes, that's exactly what does happen. You can be guided by the love of God and love of friends.
Definitely. That was great.
Can I ask one question before you end?
Sure.
Because you live with like 400 students. What's that like?
Oh, it's fine. Are we recording now? Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. It's fun living with them because I see them in the morning. I go into class, and sometimes Monday morning's pretty hard to get up. And I say, oh, hard weekend, long weekend. Yeah, they're very quiet. But we get to say good morning to each other as we go in according to the days. And then in the evening, I see them as they come in. And sometimes they, if they want something, they'll come knock at my door. However, I do say the students do respect my privacy and are very considerate of that. I have a prayer group that I meet with once a week. We meet from 9 until 10 on a Tuesday night. And they just sit around the floor on the, in my apartment. And sometimes we have mass in my apartment. One of the priests comes and says mass, and in fact, that's scheduled for 2 weeks from Tuesday. We're going to have a mass there by Father Garanzini, who has done so much to advance our campus and change the complete look of it. And now he's our chancellor. Mm-hmm.